The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1 with Kia Credit. You can drive a great deal with flexible finance from Kia, home of the 7-year warranty. The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1 with the Kia Sportage. When you test drive the Kia Sportage, then prepare to be noticed.
Hello and good morning. But I want to introduce you now to a mother and son, Diane Crahan from Coolock here in Dublin. Good morning. You're very welcome. And Alan Crahan, good morning too.
How are you doing, John?
And writing is a big part of what you do now, Alan, after I suppose, a life in crime.
Yeah, pretty much so. You know, like, that's all I do mostly with my time is write, whether it's scripts, whether it's plays, or, you know, like the book that I had released, Wild Child, and I'm currently working on a second book.
And it sort of, the writing runs in the family, because your brother Declan, we should point out, is one of Ireland's most successful TV writers, with credits on Waking the Dead, Taggart, The Bill, and there's a fourth,
Silent Witness, and
plenty more.
Oh yeah, the list is endless.
Yes. Now, Alan, we were mentioning the fact that you were, I suppose, a career criminal, and we can remind ourselves of your interview with RTE's Would You Believe. I think this was about 20 years ago.
It would have been the early 90s, very early 90s.
And you were
around 1991.
And you were in Mountjoy.
And I was in Mountjoy, yeah.
Let's have a listen now.
My whole life revolves around crime, you know. Like, I grew up with criminals. I grew up into a way of life where I only knew criminals, and the only people I got to know were criminals, you know, and the only people that had time for me were criminals, you know, or thieves, you know. Like, again, robbing for me was a compulsion in the alcoholic sense. I thrived on it, you know what I mean, because I loved it, you know what I mean, booting around in cars, doing smash and grabs, you know, running around the country like a lunatic, you know, robbing boutique shops and what have you, you know. Like, I thrived on it, I loved the excitement in it. 9 out of 10 times I got away, but that one time I always get caught. And I was always sent to prison because it was always a serious charge, you know.
Listening to that now, how do you feel, Alan?
I know, it's weird hearing that back, you know. But yeah, you know, I was as truthful then as I am today, basically. Do you know what I mean? You know, it's my story, and it's the life that I led. Do you know what I mean?
And what did you serve time for specifically?
I served time for joyriding. Two separate charges for ABH, which were stabbings and armed robbery and hijacking a taxi. Yeah.
And how long did you spend in prison in total?
Within a 10-year period, I spent just under 9 years in total in prison, you know. So,
on different charges?
All on different charges, yeah. And most of them were circuit court charges,
right.
You know.
And your victims along the way, were they just random people who came across you?
No, well, the two people that I stabbed, they would have done the same to me, given half the chance, you know. Like, they weren't angels themselves, do you know what I mean? Like, they weren't innocent people, or, you know, somebody I just picked a fight with in a pub, do you know what I mean? Like, there were people with a criminal history similar to my own, do you know what I mean? So,
things got out of hand.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know what I mean? Like, and the only way I felt I could protect myself was by carrying a blade, you know, because of, you know, I don't know, you know, there's a lot of things that happened to me in my early childhood that I suppose I subconsciously put these shields, these defence mechanisms up in front of me. And, you know, the carrying of a blade for me was kind of my defender, you know, that I felt safe leaving me home, that if anybody said anything or I got into a confrontational situation, you know, the blade would come out, I'd cut the person up and that'd be the end of it.
You had some protection.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
And getting a retaliation at first in some cases.
First in, best dressed. Do you know what I mean? Like, and, you know, I suppose, like, when I was, you know, I could turn around and say, I was sexually abused when I was 5 years of age by somebody who lives in the area. Do you know what I mean? An older man, do you know what I mean? And you know, today I say, you know, well, he was sick. I don't mean in the tabloid sense. I mean, like, he was genuinely something wrong with his mind. You know, I think you have to be a paedophile or to interfere with people.
What age were you when this happened?
I was about 5. And then when I was about 12... these older guys who were in their late teens and early 20s used to congregate in a field drinking, and they would call me over and they would strip me naked and make me dance in front of them, and, you know, they'd spit in my face, and anytime they see me, they give me, you know. And one day I took up a blade and I opened one of their faces with a journeyman, and it ceased. It stopped from there on in, you know. And subconsciously, I started to develop some sort of a reputation. I had no idea I had this reputation that as a blade carrier, you know, be wary of him, journeyman. He always has a blade on him, journeyman. Like,
and it wasn't just a blade. At one stage, you actually became a machete.
I had a machete, inside my jacket, and that was there was a kickboxer, and he gave me a kick in the chest in the middle of the road, and he sent me halfway across the road, and the back of my head busted off the corner of the pavement, and I was letting on to be moaning on the ground, and he was walking up and down, you know, brazenly, kind of, you know, beckoning me to get up off the ground with his fingers, saying, come on, Krogan, I'll give it to you. Mm-hmm. And I unzipped my jacket, and I just snuck out the machete, and just gave him a belt of it across the head, you know. And
what sort of injuries did you inflict?
He got 17 stitches in the head, and I got 12 months in prison for it. You know.
So looking back at that now, I mean, when did you mentioned the sexual abuse? How long did that go on for?
Oh, the only time I remember it is one, and I remember just the I go into more detail about that and my life, and I'm very open and honest in my book Wild Child. Do you know what I mean? And I just remember the stench of urine that he had off him. Do you know the kind of way? Like, and you know, it was very, very hard to write about it, but at the same time, it was the most therapeutic thing I ever did in my entire life. You know, I'll always be willing to make amends to the people that I've hurt or harmed in the past, John. You know, and that's God's honest truth. Do you know what I mean? Like, because something happened to me. Do you know what I mean? That, you know, my life was either feast or famine. There was never any middle ground. If I wasn't flying on Concorde, which I did, I was homeless in London. You know, if I wasn't working for the Sunday Mirror or the Sunday World, or as a journalist, do you know what I mean? I was out mingling with, you know, former provisional members of the IRA, or, you know, members of organised crime, or something like that, you know?
Tell me now, you mentioned the sexual abuse at the age of 5. What age did you actually begin dabbling in crime?
Well, I was caught behind the wheel of my first car when I was only 8 years of age. It was a brown Mark 1 Ford Escort. And
Who did you steal it from? Where did you steal it?
There used to be an old post office on Greencastle Road in Coolock. It's long gone now, many, many years. And it was parked outside there. And the key was in the ignition, and I jumped into it and started it up, and I drove, and off I went. And but in order for me to see above the dashboard, I had to take the spare wheel out and put it into the driver's seat and sit on it. And me and another chap robbed it. And, you know, I think I only had the car about 5 minutes when the police came behind me and put the sirens on. And I seen a wedding car pull. It was coming down a road, and it was a kind of like a T-junction. And I seen a wedding car pulling away, and I missed the wedding car, I'd say, by inches, you know, and I ended up in the bride's front garden. And I remember the guard coming up to me, and he was banging on the window. He was a big culgy, and he was banging on the window, and he was saying, open the door, open the door. And I was saying, read me your rights, do you know what I mean? So he put the window through, and he just dragged me out by the ears, do you know what I mean? Like, and that was me.
And you had to reach up to the steering wheel and be able to see out through the windscreen. You had the spare tyre underneath you.
Yeah, to sit on, to give me some height, yeah.
And he dragged you out of the car.
Oh, yeah, dragged out by the ears, and, you know, and that was... But I got a JLO. See, I used to get a lot of JLOs, which were, you know...
Explain kinda, them.
A guard, a sergeant, or a superintendent sit you down.
Liaison officer.
Yeah, we'll tell you the rights and wrongs of life and society and all that kind of. But it just went in one ear and out the other, you know. And I suppose, you know, things kind of snowballed from there. You know, alcohol came into my life, and you know, and that gave me a complete false sense of who I really was.
Of confidence.
Yeah. Well, it gave me, you know. I was able to, you know, mingle with people. I was able to kind of, you know, I was the life and soul of any party.
What age were you when you started drinking?
Oh, jeez, I remember. I would have been around, I'd say, close to 8 or 9. Mm. You know, so some guys had robbed a pub. Actually, one of them is dead now, God rest his soul. But they'd robbed a pub and they gave me 4 bottles of Carlsberg specials. I'll never forget it. And I think I drank about 2 of them. And then I just blacked out, you know. But that was the first time I ever drank. Mm. And it just continued on from there.
Sure.
And I drank everything. You know, I was rip-roaring alcoholic. You know, but I had no knowledge of it. Do you know what I mean? But anything I touched, you know, I would do well, you know, at what I was doing.
Mm.
You know, and I would get to a certain height. You know, even as a journalist, I achieved, you know, I got some cracking stories, do you know what I mean?
Because of your knowledge of criminals and
stuff like
your ability
to
source information.
Well, if somebody was shot, you know, I would just ring a criminal that I'd know, and any criminal, you know what I mean, who would be close, and they would tell me why the person was shot.
Sure, and we'll get to that later, your subsequent life as a journalist. And Diane, when you're listening to that now, were you aware of all Alan's criminal episodes?
No. Not at that time. I wasn't aware of it at all. I wasn't even aware of normally under normal circumstances, what really should have happened in that time was that the child was brought back to the parents, or the parents were sent for. I know there was no phones then, like, you know, but the parents were sent for by the guards,
no mobile phones,
and brought to the station and told. I was never sent for by the guards in Coolock. Never sent for at all. My first awareness of Alan getting into trouble was one night when I came home from work. It would have been about 12 o'clock, maybe 1 o'clock in the morning. And a lady drove me home, and I was in her car. And I had no cigarettes. At that time, I used to smoke. And I had no cigarettes. And a house up the road around the corner used to sell cigarettes. So there was no shops open at that time. So I asked Alan, would he go up to the shop and get me cigarettes in the house? And I gave him the money, and I was waiting for him to come back. And when he didn't come back, I saw some lads, and I said, "Hiya, guys." I said, "Did you see Alan anywhere?" He said, "Oh, the Mariah is after taking him away." I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, the Mariah's after taking him away." So my friend drove me down to the Garda station. And I went in and I said, "I believe you've got my son, Alan, here." And they said, "Oh, yes." But he said, "He'll be out in an hour." I said, "Oh, I'm sorry." I said, "But he's a juvenile." I said, "He's only 15 years old." And I said, "I'm sorry. It's my constitutional right," I said, "to be present when my son is being questioned." And they said, "Get out of the station." And I said, "No, I will not get out at the station." I said, "You know," I said, says I, "I'm just coming home from work." And he said, "Where do you work?" I said, "In the Burlington Hotel." And he said, "Inside or outside?" I said, "How dare you speak to me like that?" I said, you know, so they threw me out of the station on the ground, and I got back up and I went back in again.
They actually physically threw you?
Physically threw me out of the station, And I said, I got back up again. And I went back in and I said, "It's my constitutional right," I said, "to see my son. You are not going to question him without me being present, because I'm not aware of him committing any crime, you know." So they actually gave me a bit of a beating and locked me in a cell in Coolock Garda station.
Yeah, when you say a beating now, what are we talking
about?
They
gave me a couple of punches and they pulled my blouse, and
this is like
they opened up the buttons in my blouse.
This is about 25 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they locked me in a cell.
Right.
But that's all water under the bridge now.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I mean, like, I was going to sue the guards, but they made it impossible for me.
Yeah, you're alleging that took place in the guard station.
That's right, the guard, we
can't stand over it. We just have to take it.
I'm sorry,
But were you aware that Alan had been sexually abused?
No.
I wasn't aware of anything
like that. He never told anybody about anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, as I said, I had a habit of feeling very sorry for young people, you know, especially
yeah,
young,
because
young lads
you're a mother of
eight.
Yeah, you're a mother of eight.
Yeah.
And before we get back to, you know, dealing with Alan and what he was getting up to, you yourself, just tell us a little bit about yourself, because you had a very tough time as you grew up.
I was abandoned by my mother at 3 years old.
She was just 16 when she gave birth.
I was left in the county home in Enniscorthy. And St. John's Hospital it is now. And I was left there, and when she ran away and she left me. And then I was fostered by a family in Kiltealy. And they were okay, they were fine to me, you know, they were very good and everything. But then when Mr. Jordan, my foster father, died, the priest came up one day and said to me, "You're coming with me," the local priest. And I said, "Where am I going?" He said, "You're not going to school today." He said, "You're coming with me." So he brought me down to this place in Wexford. It was a long, long drive. I didn't know at the time where it was, but he brought me on a long drive, and he brought me into this room and put me into the room and said, "You sit there and I'll be back in a while." And he never came back. And then the nuns came in then and told me then to take off my clothes and get into this uniform. And for 4 years, I was in that uniform.
And that was in the Mercy Convent?
In the Mercy Convent in Summerhill in Wexford.
Yeah. And tell us about your time there. You were what, 9 when you arrived?
I was 8 going on 9. I couldn't be really specific, mm-hmm. but I knew that I'd made my Holy Communion and I hadn't made my confirmation. That was the only, you know, and I still, my shoes for my Holy Communion still fitted me. So I assumed that it was just shortly after my Holy Communion.
And you were put to work in the convent.
I was put to work in the laundry, yeah. And I was a bit small at the time, so they gave me a box to stand on to get up to the calendar for to put the sheets through. But if they weren't straight, woe betide you if you didn't have that sheet straight, you know. Mm-hmm. And we got fed in the morning. We went to Mass first. Then we came home and then we got fed. We got a bit of bread and brown bread and maybe sometimes cocoa, sometimes tea. And then we went to work then, and we worked then for the day. And then at night time then, we got a meal, like, you know, something, I don't know what it was. It was some sort of food, potatoes and vegetables or something like that. And then we were sent to bed around about 8:30.
And how were you treated?
Very badly.
Why? Tell
Very
us.
Badly. We were beaten, you know, because I was a bit, you see.
Why would you be beaten?
For maybe misbehaving, you know, like, I don't mean misbehaving in a bad way. I mean objecting to certain things, like, you know, like when you were brought up to get washed. If you were last, if you were first, you were fine. But if you were last to come up to the trough for to put your head into it, for to wash your hair, the lice were crawling on top of it. And of course, naturally, you'd object and say, you know, and they push your head into it, you know. And then because I was left-handed, I got a whipping on my hand, and I still have the mark on my hand where they opened my hand with a leather strap for not using my right hand.
So they forced you basically
they
to change hands from left
yeah,
hand.
Yeah,
you were naturally left-handed.
Yeah.
And that was over a period of time.
Yeah. And then, of course, when I escaped then and got caught, the police brought me back.
Yes, because you were trying to escape constantly, really.
Yeah, I was.
Other girls there were just wanted to get the hell out?
See, there were some people there. There were some girls there who were there for a very long time. Mm. But there was other people there who had experienced the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
And to be locked up for not committing a crime was a horrible thing. I never allowed out. Mm. And I just wanted to get home. And that was it.
And what happened eventually? You finally actually managed
then
to escape.
Finally, I saw the opportunity. We were brought out the big baskets on wheels.
Laundry,
we brought
laundry
them out
baskets.
To the laundry van. And me and this other girl, we got the opportunity of when the fellas were talking, right? And while they were talking, we got in behind the laundry vans, the laundry truck, you know, the baskets,
mm-hmm.
and hid down behind them. And as soon as they went to White's Hotel in Wexford and went in to get to put in the report that they had the laundry, we subsequently run out of it, mm-hmm. and That's the rest is history. I came to Dublin then. I don't know how I got to Dublin. I haven't got a clue.
You can't remember?
I can't remember how I got to Dublin.
Can you remember arriving here and where?
I can remember walking up a street and there was this man with a whistle, a very big man, out, and the name of the place was the Gresham Hotel. And I remember going over to him and asking him. Now, at the time, I thought he was a policeman. I didn't know what he was because I never knew what a policeman was like. So I went up and I asked him, was there anywhere that he could recommend that? Well, I didn't use the word recommend at the time, but where he could tell me to stay. And he directed me up to a place outside the Rotunda Hospital, across the road from the Rotunda. And there was a hostel there. And I went up and I went in and I told them that this man sent me up and told me I was at Gresham Hotel and told me it was okay to come up. So they took me in, put me into a little room, right, so a tiny little room, and I was grand. I was happy about that. I had somewhere to sleep. So then 2 days later, the gentleman in question came up with a lady and a gentleman from Bald's Bridge. And they were looking for somebody to look after their children. Apparently, they used to dine in the Gresham Hotel. And he brought them up to me. And they took me then to Corn Market, had me medically examined for to see if I had any diseases or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And then they took me into their home. And I stayed there for 2 years looking after their children. So I was sure of a bed, I was sure of my food, and I got a few bob as well.
And you eventually left then?
I eventually left then because I wanted a little bit more freedom, because I was only allowed out every Tuesday, half day on Thursday, and every second Sunday.
Right.
But then I found out there was a family on Marion Road in Bald's Bridge, and they were looking for somebody, and I went to them and asked them, and they didn't have any children, so it was grand, and I was allowed out every night.
Okay,
so
more,
it was great,
more,
you know.
More freedom, yeah.
Yeah, and, more freedom.
And, at what stage then did you meet your future husband and
oh, God,
settle down?
It was 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. I would have been about 17 going on 18
okay.
when I met him, and I met him in the Olympic Ballroom. And used to dance there mm-hmm. in the Olympic Ballroom, and I worked in the Rainbow Cafe in O'Connell Street. But I was on holidays and I didn't have anywhere to go for my holidays, but you had to take them, like, you know. So I went to work in Tato in Harold's Cross, and working in Tato in Harold's Cross, I first had the encounter with him mm-hmm. and then at the dance hall. You
right,
know,
okay.
So that's how I met.
And you settled down in Coolock and
I well, no, we didn't. We settled. We went first of all to a bedsit up in Belvedere Place. Sorry, I'm holding you up.
No,
in Belvedere Place. And then we went then from there then my mother in law got me a flat, 2 room flat in Golden Lane, in Piles Buildings in Golden Lane. That was in the Liberties of Dublin.
Uh-huh.
And then we went from there then. I had my fourth child, and I felt like I could not stay in 2 rooms, like with four children all sleeping in 1 room, you know. So I asked the corporation, I applied to the corporation for to get a place. They said no, that I didn't qualify at the time. So then we decided we applied for to get an assisted passage, and we went to Canada on an assisted passage. £10 it was,
sure.
You know, yeah. And we went to Canada with the four children and my husband and myself.
Right.
We went to Canada, yeah.
And you came back in 1969 then,
yeah.
After 3 years
yeah,
there.
Yeah, when Alan was born.
68.
The year Alan was born.
Was born
yeah,
in Canada.
Yeah.
And Alan was, what, the sixth, was it your sixth child, Alan was? Or
he was
Declan,
Julie, Michelle,
William,
fifth.
Fifth, yeah. All right, okay. So you settled down eventually and you had children, and
yes.
I know it's been a difficult
yeah, and we moved then to Coolock. I love a little house in Coolock when we come back from Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's been a difficult marriage for you. Your husband has a drink problem.
It was difficult. Yeah, he
yeah,
took
sure.
a nervous breakdown as well,
uh-huh.
You see. He worked in Grange Gorman, and his first encounter was that he took a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
And he couldn't work anymore.
Sure.
You know, so I had to go out and work. I was working while he was working.
So there was a lot of pressure on you
as
the
yeah.
person keeping
yeah, but
the,
I didn't mind, you know,
yeah.
I didn't mind.
And just to bring people up to date, you actually got involved in the campaign for justice for victims of the Magdalen Laundries.
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. I thanks to Christine Buckley, she was the first person, the Lord of Mercy on her, she was the first person to bring it, make people aware that this was at the, this was, it was a wrongdoing, you know. And then, of course, Stephen O'Riordan, I have to mention about Stephen. He's a magnificent young man and he's very, very good. And it was him that helped along the way. But only 6 months, 8 months ago, the actual Magdalen Laundry, the Summer Hill in Wexford and Stanhope Street were only accepted as Magdalen Laundries. Okay. Up to that, even though I was fighting with all the rest of the women and going to the meetings and everything, I had still hadn't been accepted as being a Magdalen Laundry.
To get Summer Hill included. But you did succeed in getting it included, yeah. And you got a few bob recently.
I did indeed, from just the Department of Justice.
Yeah, explain. How much did you get?
I got 14,500.
14,500, and that was to cover the period
for 6 months. They said, you see, the nuns gave in a record that I was only 6 months there from the time I was 15. I went in April when I was and stayed there till September. That was wrong. I was in Dublin, well in Dublin, when I was 15 years old. You know, but their word was taken, unfortunately. I made an appeal against it. I lost my appeal. So I said, no, I wouldn't. So I had a little bit of a stroke there a few weeks ago. And I decided it's not worth it. It's not worth the fight. Money doesn't buy happiness and it doesn't buy good health.
So you're going to accept then the amount that you've received?
I did accept it, yes.
And you're going to leave the fight there?
I leave the fight there. But I still go fighting for the ladies who haven't been compensated yet.
Sure.
I'm still there for them.
Right, to help them out in their efforts. Now, Alan and Diane are staying with us and we'll be back in a moment with more.
The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1.
And you're very welcome back with me this morning, Diane Crohan and her son, Alan. Alan, you were talking earlier about your life in crime, and a lot of listeners getting in touch and saying there's no remorse there, and you know that you're not so much you are owning up to what you did, but that it doesn't sound as if you feel that it was the wrong thing to do.
No, I can understand where the listeners are coming from, and maybe the tone and the manner of my voice seems kind of like really kind of blasé and matter of fact and stuff like that, you know. But I've went to people and I've made amends to people that, you know, I didn't want to go to, people that I was afraid to go to. Do you know what I mean?
Why would you have been afraid?
Because there was a lot of fear around kind of approaching somebody that I've hurt and harmed, you know, and what their reaction would be. But no matter what I'll always be willing to make amends. And the thing is that the people that I made amends to, they're the only people that I'm concerned about, are the people that I hurt and harmed. And, you know, to give them some sort of peace of mind, or to let them know how genuinely sorry, you know, I truly was for the things that I had done. Do you know what I mean?
So what would you have said to them, that if you did come across some of the people who you injured seriously, what would you have said to them?
Well, I went to one guy and I done a very, very bad thing on him.
What was that?
I stuck him on the front page of the Sunday World, you know, and exposed him.
In what way?
Well, I exposed him for having fraudulent passports, do you know what I mean? But the thing is, I knew this person.
Oh, right, this is to do with your career as a journalist, not as a criminal.
But there was also people that I stabbed and stuff that I had to go to, you know, even people that got me sent to prison. Do you know what I mean?
And there was an armed robbery as well.
That's right.
We didn't mention that.
Yeah.
But tell us a little bit about that as well.
Well, the armed robbery was in College Green, the Bank of Ireland in College Green. I think it's closed down now, but myself and another lad, he's still on the run now today. He's never been convicted, but we just went in with an imitation handgun and told everybody to go down on the floor and I think I had about 8,000 down my jumper when I was caught. I was caught in Bloom's Hotel, because when we came outside, the armed guardie with flank jackets and all were outside the bank, and I just had her on my toes, and it was cotton blooms.
And how long did you serve?
I got 3.5 years.
3.5 years.
Yeah.
And just the individuals then, you mentioned earlier in the show that you actually harmed with your blade or your machete.
Yeah.
Have you had an opportunity, or have you met any of them since?
Oh, I have.
They live locally.
Yeah, Jesus,
and would you have made a point of going up and apologising?
Oh, absolutely. John, I mean, like, I went up, like, you know, even, as I said, like, you know, individuals that got me sent to prison, you know, and the reason why I wanted to go up to them and approach them was to let them know how genuinely sorry I was, and that I deserved to go to prison, and I deserved what happened, and they were, you know, correcting everything that they did. That I was totally way off the, I was steeped in alcoholism. I was rip-roaring alcoholic, and I had no morals. I didn't care about anybody. But I knew somewhere deep inside me, like, when I wasn't drinking, you know, people were saying, Alan, you know, you're so down to earth and you're so genuine when you're not drinking. But when you drink, you're like a Jekyll and Hyde character. You're either the life and soul of the party, or you just turn really violent.
Sure.
I'm
just wondering, Diane, you're obviously aware, you became aware then that that Alan was getting in trouble with the law.
Yeah.
How did you react? Because you were, as I said, you're a busy woman with 8 children to rear. Did you ever think of trying him out?
No. That's one thing I don't approve of. Parents should not throw the children out, you know, because you throw out, it's like throwing out a problem. And it's like giving somebody else your problems. And I wasn't in the habit of giving anybody else my problems. He was my problem, and I was going to deal with it as best I could. So I tried to advise him. I tried to stop him. On a few occasions, I chased after the robbed car. It was one outside my gate one night, and Alan was in it. And I went out and I ran out onto the street, and I threw a brick through the window.
Of the car that Alan was in
to try and stop them. But the police were there as well. You know,
and why did you throw the brick?
To stop it.
Yeah, but you knew it was Alan.
In a reaction, you know.
So you were very angry, obviously.
I was, yeah.
And did you express that anger to Alan?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. I mean, when I come home from work at 4 o'clock in the morning from the Shelburne or the Burlington Hotel, and I used to cycle on a bike, you know, and when I'd come home, like, and realise that he wasn't in the bed. I mean, I often went out and walked around the streets trying to look to see where he was. But my husband would be sort of intoxicated. And then he was on tablets as well for his depression. So he would be asleep and he wouldn't even know that Alan was gone, you know. And the rest of the children were there. When I find he wasn't in bed, I used to go out looking for him. Not all the time, but best part of the time I did, you
know.
And
you must have had many sleepless nights.
Pardon?
You must have had a lot of sleepless nights.
Yes, I did. I did have a lot of sleepless nights, yeah. I did. Like, as I said, it wasn't easy. But what can you do? I mean, what can you do with somebody, with a child? I mean, if you throw them out, you're throwing them out to be somebody else's problem, and they're causing more havoc, you know, by throwing them out, you know.
And what did his brothers and sisters make of it?
Well, they were sort of saying, like, trying to advise me and what to do and what not to do, you know, and but they were getting on with their own lives. And, you know, I mean, at one stage I had the whole 8 of them there, like, you know, living. But then, like, they moved on, you know, and Alan was still drinking and, you know, and but they used to say, oh, that Alan fell again, you know what I mean, you know. So, like, but I was more embarrassed by what the neighbours thought. I'm very much aware of what the neighbours would think, you know.
Right.
You know, but I mean, I remember one time a neighbour came up to my door and asked him to steal his car, and he offered him £50 to steal his car.
Right.
And I heard him at the door and I went down and I let him have it. I said, how dare you? I said, when you should try to encourage children not to do things, you're encouraging them, you know, to be bad, you know.
Yeah, and Alan, I mean, this isn't something that just look, you say at this stage now you've got your life together, but there was also a period in your life when you were a male prostitute.
That's right, yeah.
And just tell us a little bit about that and how that started.
Well, I originally started working for an escort agency in the Dublin 4 area, and in the capacity of a driver. Basically what I would do, if the girls got a call out, you know, to a client's home or to a hotel or whatever, I would bring them there. I'd wait outside, you know, because they'd have an hour. And, you know, if they weren't out after the hour, I was supposed to knock at the door and say, mm-hmm. like, make sure they're okay, basically. Do you know what I mean? And then what was involved, the owner, the pimp, if you like, he advertised in the In Dublin magazine, Coffee and Cream, like me and one of the girls, do you know what I mean? Like, to get more clients in and stuff like that. And
so in this way, you would have been as a prostitute.
Yes,
you're talking
yeah.
about, not just driving the prostitutes to the locations.
It involves more, do you know what I mean? Like,
and we're talking about what?
Male and female
clients.
Do you know what I mean? Like that, I come out to houses and stuff like that, and a lot of them would be well to do. Do you know what I mean? Like fancy houses, hidden secret alarms around the homes and stuff like that, beside their beds and stuff like that. Like, you know, kind of very wealthy people. Do you know what I mean?
And did you get well paid for it?
I got 180 quid an hour plus a tax, plus the taxi fare, but I had my own car, but I still charged them for the taxi. Do you know what I mean? And then
With that 180 then, with the pimp tax,
I'd get half.
So you'd get 90 out of the 180.
Yeah.
And how long did you do that for, and how busy were you?
Well, I basically done that for about 9 to 10 months, but I ended up falling in love with, well, going out with one of the girls from the escort agency, and she got me to live. She says, because I know what all the girls are like, do you know what I mean? And we ended up having a relationship for 2.5 years, Sex for me was just as big as a problem as my alcoholism was. Do you know what I mean? It dominated a part of my life for a number of years. And the whole thing with sex, having sex and opening risky places and threesomes and all that kind of stuff. Do you know what I mean? I was totally open-minded. Do you know what I mean? And as I says, like in my book Wild Child, I go into much more finer detail,
sure.
kind of in relation to
and
that.
And what about the
know?
Dangers to your health?
I never thought about it, John. I never thought about it. Like I never used condoms, and I know this may be probably embarrassing for my mother to me to be speaking about such a sensitive subject. Do you know what I mean? But I'm an honest person. Do you know what I mean? And I believe through the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that, and the 12-step program that has me here today. Do you know what I mean? Like, I open my mind to God every morning. I'm not a religious person, far from it.
But your health, Alan, I mean, you've discovered in recent times that you have certain conditions that mean...
Yeah, I have four life-threatening illnesses, if you like. One is cirrhosis of the liver. The other one is hepatic encephalopathy, which is basically the liver can't clear the toxins from the blood, and it's associated with end-stage liver disease, which in itself is very dangerous. I have varices in the esophagus, which if one of them bursts, a little bubbles of blood, in the esophagus, and one of them bursts, fatality is instant. And then I have portopulmonary hypertension, which is a very, very rare disorder.
And is this all to do with the life you've led?
Yeah, I've nobody to blame but myself, because of the drugs and the cocaine, the ecstasy, the LSD and sniffing gas, sniffing petrol, you name it, I took it, you know what I mean? But alcohol was the the prominent feature in me life. It was always there was always alcohol involved, even when I worked as a journalist. Do you know what I mean? Like, I went off to have lunch, or if I was interviewing somebody, whether it was a politician or somebody with a human interest story to tell, I'd meet them in a pub or a hotel. Do you know what I mean? After work, when it's with the Sunday World, it was across the Brady's and Terry and Newark.
You're off drink now.
I haven't had any mind altering substances since the 10th of December 2007.
Right, so that's over 6 years ago.
Yeah, and even though I had these illnesses today, you know.
And what are the doctors saying? Yeah, what are the doctors saying about those illnesses and your prognosis?
Well, all they're saying is that, Alan, you're a very, very, very complex case. Do you know what I mean? But in my research on medical websites that I've went to, you know, the lifespan, the longevity of my lifespan doesn't make for good reading.
And what is it?
Well, especially for the part of pulmonary hypertension, without treatment, you don't know the cause of it, and you don't know, and you can't cure it. Right? They can only try and give you treatment for it, and without treatment, they're looking at from the time of diagnosis to 15 months. With treatment, 2 to 3 years. With a liver transplant, 5 years. You know, and then I done my research, and I printed all this stuff out, and I stapled it off, and I have it all sectioned like in a file, like a medical file.
Yeah.
Do you know what
so
I mean?
Just there is the strong possibility that you might just have a few years left.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You know, and I found acceptance around that inside my own head, which is very, very hard thing, at the time.
Yeah.
Because I was, you know, it was the first time that I was faced with dealing with my own mortality. You know, and I got into bed for weeks, and I had to pull the curtains, and I got really, really depressed down in myself, and, you know, and I prayed, do you know what I mean? Like, and I still go in to visit a Jesuit priest every single week. He's a dear friend of mine. He's a fantastic man, do you know what I mean? I had him for the last 6.5 years. But, you know, I've got acceptance around it, do you know what I mean? And I'm still a very, very contented recovering alcoholic.
But you're 44 now, and you know that you mightn't see 50.
Yeah, when the man above says it's time for Alan to check out his hotel, it's you know, it's adios amigos. Sure. Ideally, I would like to have my second book published. I have the script written for it, the film script written for it already.
Yeah.
So I'd like to see some sort of financial reward come back from that. So my two nephews, that leave me, you know, I could put something into a trust fund for them, pay for my own funeral, and then leave me man with the rest of the money. And I'd be happy, you know, I'd be...
Diane, you're sitting there and you're taking in all this, and I mean, would you have been aware about Alan and the male prostitution?
No. Alan had, by that time, had actually moved out to a flat. You know, himself, voluntarily, he moved himself, you know, and I wasn't aware of that, you know.
Until today.
Well, yeah, I knew it was in the book.
Sure.
You know.
And did you read the book?
No.
Yeah. And why? Just.
I just don't want to.
You don't want to know?
No. Yeah. No.
You just don't want to
try. But what I don't know won't hurt me.
Yeah.
You know?
But hearing about it this morning and the different things Alan has been saying, how do you feel? Do you think it's some way, you know, that things could have been better, and, you know, do you think, are there regrets, in other words?
I don't know. I think life is a destiny. Whatever is marked out for you happens, and in my book, what will be, you know, and your life is cut out for you. That's the way I look at it, you know. And I always believe that the day you're born, there's a number up there, and they know the day you're going to die. You know, life is planned for
and
you.
when you listen to Alan saying about his prognosis,
yeah,
the possibility that he may only live another few years, how do you feel?
I accept it. I accept that, hoping that every day is a bonus, you know. But then with us all, isn't every day a bonus, really, when you think about it, you know?
Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah, and some of our listeners have been onto us, and they're just inquiring about, did you ever try to meet your birth mother? And
I did meet my birth mother, yes. I met her first when I was 17 years old. I went on the boat over to Manchester. I discovered she was living in Manchester, and I got an address for her. And I went over, but when the address I got was the wrong address, she wasn't there anymore. So then I went around and the people told me some people told me where she lived, and I went to her address. And when I went to her address, she was very, very frightened, and she didn't want to know me. And she passed me off as her niece to her husband. She was married and she had two boys at the time. And she passed me off as her niece. So that just...
Oh, then, did you call to the house?
Yes.
Right.
And I said, I told her who I was. And she said, oh, come in. You know, don't let anybody see you.
So she had no idea that you had tracked her down?
No.
Yeah.
No.
And she was very... So you became her niece, though?
I became her niece then. So then she got me a job working in a Jewish place, in a Jewish house, doing domestic, you know. And it was a live-in. And that was to get rid of me out of the way, you know. Mm-hmm. So I sort of just made up enough money out of my wages and came back to Dublin. And that was the last I saw of my mother until I got a phone call from a lady who was my aunt. Not a phone call, a letter, I'm sorry, from my aunt who I never met, and told me that my mother was dying and that she had senile dementia. So then her son, my brother, my half-brother, Michael, he got my address and he wrote to me and asked me to go over. So he paid for my fare over and all that, you know what I mean? But unfortunately, I didn't know anything about travelling by air that time and I had no passport and flight. I couldn't Ryanair. Go on a flight.
Airlines.
You know, Ryanair wouldn't let me go on the flight.
Without the passport. Right. How long was that after you had first met your birth mother that you got that phone call?
That's only about 9 years ago. Mm.
But to the time then you got that call from your aunt.
Yeah. So I went over anyway to her, and she was in hospital. She was in bed at the time. And Michael said, do you want to go over to her? And I said, I will. Would she know me? Oh, she knows you all right, you know. So I went over to her and she just pulled me down and she says to me, I'm very sorry. And will you find Teresa? And my brother said, who in the name of God is Teresa? How many more skeletons has mother got in the cupboard? Mm. You know, so we had to try and find. We
and
got over the burial.
And who was Teresa?
Everything else. Teresa was my sister.
Okay.
Who was abandoned in the Regina Chaley in Dublin by my mother 6 years after I was born. She came up to Dublin, she had a baby and she abandoned her at 2 years old. And she was brought to the courts here in Dublin and charged with being destitute. And she was sentenced to 14 years in an industrial schooling cabin.
So, yeah. And you tracked your sister?
Right? I did. I got her through Bernardo's. Yeah.
Right,
Bernardo's.
So you've had, a difficult life in many ways.
Yeah, Diane. I had a happy life.
Yeah.
And I think God was very good to me, really. When you think about it, he opened doors for me. You know, I never had any encounter with the law.
Mm.
I never drank or anything like that, and I've never broke my pledge.
Right.
You know, and I did smoke, all right, you know, and I danced 7 nights a week. But,
all right, that's allowed. Since you, and I mentioned at the outset the great success of Alan's brother Declan.
Yeah.
He lives in the States now,
yeah.
And he's a very successful TV writer. That must bring you great joy as well.
Yeah, of course it does. Of course it does. But the only thing is, as I said, I'm proud of his achievements, and I'm proud of Alan, what he's after turning himself into, but I'm proud of all my kids, every one of them, regardless, you know, they kept me sane, even if it was something to worry about, something not to worry about, but they just kept me going, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you need something to go activity, and I mean, I still work, you know, I'm working in Croke Park. You know,
It's 73.
I'm a waitress now.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Been a waitress for years.
Right. So you're working away in Croke Park at the big events there. And Alan lives at home.
He does.
Yeah. You never quite got rid of him. Anyway.
No, just for a while. Just while he was being a bad
be
boy.
Apart from
if it rained £5, you get a bang in the empty safe.
Yeah. Alan, are you ever tempted to go back in the drink? Are you ever tempted to go back to crime, to a life of crime?
No. It's just, you know. For me today, John, it's just about not hurting or harming another human being. The thoughts of a drink, it's like I never drank. Do you know what I mean? I don't have that obsession. I don't have that mind-bending obsession, that, you know, that desire, that urge, that want, that need to drink. You know, if you knew Alan, who was drinking and drugging and doing all that kind of stuff, do you know what I mean? Mm. And you're seeing this Alan that you're seeing now today, you would turn around and say, two completely different people. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
And you also have words of advice for your nieces and nephews. You tell them what
to... Yeah, I can spot a child that's going to go off the rails very easily because I can usually see myself in them. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And that's why, you know, I go to a lot of secondary schools and give talks to the kids in the third year, fifth year and sixth year. Do you know what I mean?
Tell them what
and they're very interactive with me. Do you know what I mean? Like, sure. And it's really good and it's something productive.
And it reminds them.
I want to be a productive human being in my life.
Okay.
You know, I want to be an asset.
Right.
You know, not a liability like the way I used to be. Okay. Do you know what I mean?
Well, the name of the book is Wild Child, and it was published last year. It was published by Penguin Ireland, and it retails at about €10. And it tells about your life
in great detail,
crime and afterwards. Alan Crahan, thanks a million for coming in, and that's Diane too.
Thank you.
Thank you too.
Thanks
and a lot
much.
Of people getting in touch with us this morning to say well done, and love your positive attitude and your acceptance of what's happened in your life thus far.
And if I may say just before you go, John, is that I would have been lost without my mother, because any time I was in the police station, any time I was up in court, my mum was there in the gallery, down to the police station, any prison I was in, whether it was Port Leash, whether it was Mountjoy, St. Patrick's, it didn't matter.
She visited you?
She was visiting me every week.
Okay.
She never let me down.
We'll have to leave it there. But Diane Crahan and Alan Crahan, thank you for coming
in
this
morning. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, John.
The best of luck for the future. And the book, as I said, is Wild Child. And that's all we have time for today. Ciarán Dunne was on sound. Our producer, Sheila O'Callaghan, and our researcher, John B. Riley. Sean is up next. We're back in the morning at 9 till then, Sláinte.
Text 51551. The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1.